Session number 12319.
Mr. Carter, heel toe.
So with the hands crossed in front of the face, you just pull them sort of apart and down, and just turn the body around. So you're now facing, instead of facing backwards, you're facing forwards. So you had a forward landing, which was considered the ideal thing. Then we used to teach them to, if they thought they were could come in sideways, to sort of do a half cross position, so it brought them in sideways. Then we used to teach them how to land if they were going to trees or into water. If they were going to trees, they had to sort of bend the knees up to the tummy, covering the tummy, cover the face, and just crash into the trees, which worked quite well, as I had experienced many years later. To water, at the time, the chap had to bang his crook loose box and turn it, pull his leg straps out, hang from his harness, and then drop into the water. That was basically the exit, flight, and landing. Now, to practice the exits, we had a high fuselages around the hangar, but we also had a gadget called the fan, or the air brake. Now, this was in the roof of the hangar, some 25 to 30 feet high, and consisted of a wire cable of about 20 foot length, which was wound round a drum. At the other end of the drum was a two-bladed propeller, or flat blades, like paddles. And a harness, which a chap slipped round his shoulders and fastened, and the word from an instructor, he made his exit and plummeted down. The wire revolved the blades, which slowed him down, hence the air brake. That was quite frightening for people the first time, who'd never been any higher than, what, second story of building, perhaps, in a block of flats. And here they were, sat on the edge there of a sheer drop below them. But once they got the hang of that, we found that they liked it and they'd come back for more. And it became one of the most popular pieces of equipment. They used to love going on to that. All the time this was going on, we used to give them more, further training and exercises. And on one occasion, we got so pushed for, I think, for accommodation at Ringway to try and speed up the number of trainees going through. We were increasing the staff of instructors all the time. The army used to be trained on their preliminary parachute training at a place called Hardwick Hall in Chesterfield. They had an assault course there. They used to come to us for the parachute training and then go back to Hardwick Hall and go on the assault course. And someone had the bright idea of the instructors going over there, doing the ground training over there, so we established a small ground training school there, then we would come back with the troops to Ringway and do the jumping at Ringway. And this worked quite well, so to get there we went by air, and we dropped out from Whitley's onto the top of a hill by Hardwick Hall. We did a very low descent. The dropping height at the time was about 600 feet, but according to what I've recorded, on that occasion we dropped somewhere in the region about 350. By the end of 1942, I had been posted abroad. There was a group of six of us. We were told to, we were sent an embarkation leave and told we were posted abroad somewhere. We didn't know where. We knew that there was a school in India, in Chaklala. So consequently, we went to Blackpool for our while we were waiting. Four of our number were suddenly spirited off one night and went off before us. While the rest of us, I think about six or eight, can't remember, we followed up later. We went out on the Queen Mary. We went up to Gourock in Scotland one dark night. And in the middle of the night, we went out in the lock or wherever, in the bay there, in this little boat, which I thought, crikey, are we going on this little thing wherever we're going? Until it pulled up. It was just getting light, and one chap said, "Good God," he said, "have you seen this?" And we all crowded around one single porthole that was open, and all we could see was the sheer side of the ship climbing higher and higher, like a block of flats. And it was the Queen Mary. We went out on the Mary, and we finished up in Port Suez. And we found that we'd been posted out to Cabrit.
So you didn't meet the enemy on the way?
No. We were fortunate, because of course we're not allowed to say how we got out there, what ship we were on, but a friend of mine had got a model of the ship on the mantelpiece at home in silver paper. So the first chance, we called in at various ports, we called in at Freetown, and we were allowed to write letters. And he wrote in his letter to his father, I cannot tell you the ship I'm on, Dad, but be careful when you're dusting the mantelpiece. And that's how his father knew he was on the Queen Mary. And from what I learnt later, we had no escort because she was considered so fast that the only way the submarine could catch her was to lay in wait. And it got very cold, and we found out we went up nearly to the Arctic Circle, practically over to Canada, Newfoundland, and then back down that way to avoid what they thought was a submarine pack waiting in the middle of the Atlantic. And we arrived in Suez in the beginning of January, and we made our way up to the reception centre, and then we were taken to Cabrit. Now, Cabrit is just on the shores of the Bitter Lake, and we found our friend who had gone before us, found they'd flown out, and as they wanted four instructors urgently, they'd been flown out in front of us. And we found there were far more instructors than we realised. We also found that these instructors had been out there about a year, 18 months, and they'd also been involved in operations, which of course made some of us envious, because we thought, oh, we'd love to have gone done all that sort of thing. It's like Markwell, he'd been on operations at the desert, and he was one of the first people we saw, because he'd just come back from a trip with a thick beard on, and evidently the aircraft had to force land, because he'd gone dropping agents behind the German lines in North Africa. The aircraft had been hit, and it had to try and get back to base, and crashed eventually. Fortunately, they all survived, but they had to sort of make their own way back, and he turned up just as we got there. Before we got there, these instructors had been involved with David Stirling, who had formed the parachute group, the Special Air Service, out there. And his idea of training his people was to use an old Bombay aircraft, jump off the backs of lorries to teach the landing, because he'd read in a book somewhere that this is what they were doing. They had very little in the way of flight technique. And it was lucky, really, that they survived to do a parachute descent at all, because they used to tear this lorry down about 20 or 30 miles an hour, I think, and hurl themselves off it, which is nothing like a parachute landing at all. They also, these four lads, Averis, Joe Welsh and McGregor, they also went to, on one trip where they had to, I think it's prior to the El Alamein operation, where they had to go and put the wind up, that's what they said, put the wind up the Italians. They created a diversion, and they discovered that there was an Italian young fascist camp in the somewhere near Tobruk, I think. And what they did, they went over with the parachutes with attachments on with them, a little explosive attached to the harness of the parachute, small dummies, and they dropped these out to give the impression that parachutes were dropping, and they were evidently a very good diversion. Except that Ginger Avery said to me, he said, down here caught the aircraft on fire, because one of them suddenly came to life in the aeroplane, and they thought the whole lot was going to go, but they managed to get it out. They were also involved in dropping agents in Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Greece, Albania, Italy. So by the time we'd got there, if you like, all the fun and excitement, if you can call it that, was over, and we were just sort of involved in the dreary run like of just training paratroops. Now, the difference out there was that in England they were using the Whittley aeroplane. Now, we used whatever aircraft were not available, were not required on bombing raid and things like that. And one of the aircraft we were using there when I arrived was the Hudson. Hudson was a small, Lockheed Hudson was a small medium bomber. And at that time, we were dropping 8 men from it. They took the rear gun turret off the top and filled that in. They constructed what they called the Buxton Bar. This was a ginormous bar which they fastened at an angle, leaning at the back end of the aeroplane, leaning forward. And the strops, we had 8 strops attached to that with a great big strong ring. And the paratroopers used to climb aboard 8 at a time with their instructor, hook the D-ring, the static lines of their parachutes, onto this strop, and that operated the parachute when they jumped. Now, the first thing we decided to do when we got more or less steady was to sort of get rid of this Buxton bar, which they were very loath to do because they said it built up confidence. We said we wanted a long cable, as we discovered that the Americans were using in the Dakota, which was their parachuting aircraft. You had this long cable on the starboard side of the aircraft. The strops that inside the aircraft were attached to that, and you attach your D-ring to the strops attached to that cable. The cable and the strops, of course, stayed in the aeroplane. The static lines were pulled out and the man jumped. It took a long while to get that established because they said, no, it would not give confidence to the paratroopers, but eventually we got it. So we started using 10, groups of 10 men instead of 8. 10 men was an ideal stick for one instructor to handle. It could give them more individual training. And it was a better all-round system altogether. As one instructor used to train 10 men and teach them every sort of aspect of the parachute jump. But the snag with the Hudson was it dropped at a higher speed than the Whittley. The Whittley's stalling speed was in the region, 70 knots or thereabout, and when it dropped, he was to throttle back to about 70 knots, 60 to 70 knots to allow him to drop out. The Hudson was nearer 110, so it was a faster speed. Not only that, it was a door the chap used to jump from, and it was a small door. So we had to get a man through that door with his parachute on his back. So what they had to do was to have one foot at the door, which is the left foot, sort of sit back on the haunches, both hands on the door, and then there was a red light and a green light just above the door. When the red came on, we used to shout action stations, and the chap would get into his position at the door. Green light on, we'd yell out go, and tap him on the back at the same time. Some of them claimed that that tap was a little bit stronger than a tap, and that's why they went out, but we tapped them on the back. And as they got outside, of course, they were whipped away in the slipstream. And a lot of them used to reckon it was the quickest left turn they ever did in the army, because they used to shoot off. It was quite fast. But it was quite a good aircraft. We could take 10 people, I'd say 10 people at a time, go up, drop them, and then come back ready for the next load. When I arrived there, we were training the elements for the replacement for the 10th Parachute Battalion, which had been raised in the Middle East, and also the 156th Parachute Battalion. Now, the 156th Parachute Battalion, both the 10th and the 156th, later dropped at Arnhem, but they had been trained in India, and they'd been trained in the from an aircraft called the Vickers Valencia, I think is the name of it. And the Vickers Valencia had a great big aperture, much like a bath. It was a wooden aeroplane, apart from the engine, of course, but it was wooden construction. It used to carry, I think, about 20 men. And the exit was made, something similar from the whittling, that the chap sat down and made his exit that way. And according to one story that was told by one of our instructors, was that they had to fasten themselves. We didn't wear parachutes when we were dispatching, but we had to wear a safety belt in the Valencia. And one of them had fastened it to this wooden strong point, very strong wooden beam, he said, above the aperture. So he thought he'd try this. He was a great big chap. He was a wrestler in Civvy Street. Weighed somewhere in the region, good 13 and a half stone. He was also a good rugby player. So he got in one day with the harness they use, the safety belt they use, on the ground, and said to one of his mates, come on, we'll see how safe this is. And he's supposed to have jumped into the aperture and ruined the aeroplane because the whole thing brought in the fuselage. I don't know how true that is. But another instructor, another pilot, claimed that he could get that aeroplane down so slow that he claimed that he was talking to a chap in the mess who was a keen fisherman and said, have you ever fished from an aeroplane? He said, no. Come with me, he said. So this chap, named Minty Eastman, warrant officer, sat this chap, strapped him in by the aperture, said, drop your line through there when we get airborne, he said, and leaves it to me. And he claimed that he took it up and he paddled the wheels of this aeroplane in the waters of the river, with this chap happily fishing away, just lifting it when it came to a bridge and dropped it over the other side. And he also said that he was flying pre-war, flying down the valley in Iraq, when the bus passed him. So it gave an idea of how quickly the aeroplane flew. I say, how true that is, I don't know. Nevertheless, the Hudson, we used that aeroplane. And we also used the Wellington, which was similar to the Whitley that we used in aperture. So we were teaching our people to jump from an aperture and from a door. And I've already mentioned that we had the 10th Battalion, the 156th Battalion, who were dropped off in the canal zone on the way home. They were going home from India, as they thought, and then they turfed them off at Suez and said, right, you're going to a conversion course in the canal zone on to learn how to jump from Hudson's. And some of them didn't like it. And we had one or two, to put it mildly, a high number of refusals from people who said, well, we're not going to go, we've been mucked around so much, we're not going to do the parachute anymore. And they just turned it in. And then...
what did you think of that battalion?
Well, we could see the point of it. The point was, with the refusals, we never... shall we say, took any action against him. The unfortunate part with these people was that they were trained paratroopers. Now, if we have a paratrooper, a trainee, and he refused, then that was his pigeon. Some of you used to say, well, you've got more courage than we have to refuse. It takes just as much courage to get up an aeroplane and say, well, I'm not going to do it, as someone doing it. So we never bothered about it. It was up to them. We prided ourselves on the fact that we never pushed them, we never forced them. If they didn't want to do it, they didn't want to do it. But chaps who were trained, they were court-martialed, so they had quite a few court-martials there, which was sad, but they were court-martialed not for refusing to jump, but for refusing to obey an order, in that they were told that the order to jump was the word from the instructor and the green light. The green light constituted an order to jump, and if they refused to obey that order, then they suffer the consequences of refusing to obey the order. But in effect, I think we had it gradually settled down, and as I say, we were training replacement for those. Plus, we were training people from the Greeks. We were training agents, which was quite funny in a way. My first course there was, I had 10 people on my course, and the usual thing was, you got these people and you said, right, your name, your rank, your number, your religion, all this, that and the other. And we were told just to ask these people not to worry about anything like religion, things like that, but just say your number, rank and name. And if they wanted to give you religion, well, that was it. So I got this group, and I said to the first chap, your name, So he looked at me and said, Smith. So perfectly true, Smith. Right, initials, EGA for it, shall we say. So I forget now. Your number? I haven't got a number yet. Oh. Rank, private. On to the next fellow. Jones. And so on. During the course of the day, I suddenly realised, it dawned upon my slow brain, that out of the 10 men, only one of them could speak English. And he was a chap who became my interpreter, and I became very friendly with him, in actual fact, later on. I met him several times afterwards. I can't think of his name for the life of me now. It probably wasn't his proper name anyway. But these chaps turned out to be two Poles, I think, two Germans, a Yugoslav, Frenchman, I can't think of all they're doing. But my interpreter friend could speak English, Arabic, French, Greek, Italian, and Yugoslav. Croat, I think he could speak, Serbo-Croat. I had a chap who could speak Polish and French. One of the others could speak German and Italian. So what I had to do was to say to this chap, I'd show him what to do, and I'd say, right, now tell him this. So we'd yatter away to the chap who could speak French, who would then talk to somebody else who could understand in French, but didn't know any other, and it could be, shall we say, the Polish, talk to the Polish and the German, and that's how I had to sort of teach them, because not one of them was English at all. They all belonged to a unit called the MO4, which was part of the SOE organisation. But we got by just saying I would say to them, I'd stand up, do a fall and say, all right, shufti, which meant watch. I said, okay. Now I said to this chap, tell them, do the same as that. And they used to look at my face, and if I looked quite reasonable, they knew they'd done it right. If they looked a bit miserable, they thought, well, I've done it wrong, I better try and do it better. And in this way, I was able to get all that course through without a single injury or anything, which I thought was quite good, really. I never had to do it before. But as someone said, I think Kipling, they learned about women from there. I learned about training people from them, because I had to sort of work hard and show them and what to do without trying to explain what to do. I had to show them and say, right, do that, and that's how you do it. And on one occasion, we were sat in a lecture, being given a lecture by, at that time we were still partly RAF and army, we had an army officer with us, and my interpreter was listening to what this officer was saying, was sat at the back, and they had whispered to the others what this chap was saying and who would turn around. And this officer turned around to me and said, Sergeant, would you mind telling your section to keep quiet? So I'd say to the chap, look, tone it down a bit. But he was still offending this chap. He still didn't like them, this chap till talking. He didn't realise he was interpreting for them. So he comes up to him and said, look, I've told you before, shut up. Stop talking while I'm talking. He said, how can people understand what I'm on about if you're talking all the time? Shut up. As he walked away, I don't suppose the bugger can understand me. He said, he can't understand the bloody word I'm saying. Which made him laugh and made me laugh after, because he was only trying to help, and I tried to explain this, but he wasn't interested. Anyway, shortly after I arrived in Kibrit, we'd heard rumours when I got there that we were moving, and sure enough, I think we'd been there about 3 or 4 months, like offhand, and we moved.
According to the notes that you've got here, you were in Kibrit from January to March 1943.
That'd be right. That'd be right. Then we moved up to a place just outside Haifa, in what was then Palestine. A place called Ramat David, which was, I believe, was on the plain of Esdraldon. It was about 10 or 15 miles.
But the unit was still called for...
But the unit was, up to that time, called 4METS, but then they changed the name of it to 4PTS. At that time, you had one parachute training school, which was Ringway, 3, which was in Chaklala in India, and 4, which was in the Middle East. 2, I don't think, ever existed, and I think we should have been 2, but they called us 4 because they called us 4METS when we opened up. They called us, for MTS because at the time they didn't want to let people know that paratroops were being trained out there, I suppose that was it. So how you can hide that fact? I mean, for years at Ringway, for a year at Ringway, they tried to hide the fact that a paratrooper was being trained at Ringway. When we got to Ramat David in Palestine, we were on our own little unit there. We moved all our equipment with us. We had much more. We had some more equipment built there for us. And as we, the time of the year we moved there, it was just more or less the rainy season. We were working outdoors, and it was very muddy and dirty. Now, instructors at the time at Ringway were given the same type of dress to wear as the aircrew, an aircrew battle dress, which is blue. And I had kept mine and taken it out to the Middle East with me. I was the only person there, I think, with one of these blue battle dresses. We still needed them in winter. And I didn't want to get this thing dirty, because once it was worn out, I couldn't get another one. I'd have to get a khaki one. And I was in the RAF, not the army. So I decided that when I was working, I'd wear my khaki drill, which rather amused some of the other staff, press chap called Jimmy Seddon, because here was I in what was a little, it was not really cold, it was it was a little warmer than English winter, but it was wet, and I was walking around wearing my KD, so he thought it was funny, so he christened me KD, and that's a name that stuck, so much so that all my troops, I think the trainer there, would never know my name. If someone said, "Do you remember KD?" "Oh yes, I remember." A sort of a fair-haired young flight sergeant who was out there. And one of the courses I had to train was a group of Greeks. One of the first courses I had in Ramat David was a group of 20. We were rather pushed for staff. We were short of staff. So we had to have, instead of the usual 10, we were given 20. And I turned up for training one day and had 20 Greeks. Of those 20, one could speak English. He was a chap by the name of Babis Makris, who was an ex-pilot, I think, with some airline or other. But he used to translate for me. I used to say to him, "This is what they do." And he would tell the rest of them. And again, they would watch me, watch my face. And for a time, there was a little problem because the way I talk, the Greek word for no is oki. So it confused them a little bit. When they came off and jumped off a piece of equipment and did a good landing, I would say okay, but I'd say oki. They thought it meant no, bad. Because yes is ne. So the Greek said ne is yes. So they realized this is just a sort of a idiosyncrasy of an Englishman, so they sort of put up with it because their friend told them, the interpreter told them, that really what I meant to say was they were doing very good, and that was it. But so I had 20 of them. I enjoyed working with them because, again, I had to work.